And good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. You can also hear us on channel 806 on Sasktel Max or channel 341 on Access Communications Digital Service. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We are building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name's Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm again joined by our co-host, Mona Hill.
Hi, everybody.
And today, a little different, we're going to present a soundtrack to a video produced by Amnesty International in conjunction with the Lubicon Cree people of Little Buffalo. The Lubicon Nation is a small Aboriginal society living in north-central Alberta, Canada. On the 26th of March, 1990, the United Nations Human Rights Committee ruled that Canada had violated the human rights of the Lubicon Cree. Let me read that again. Canada had violated the human rights of the Lubicon Cree. The ruling was based on evidence that Canada had failed to recognize and protect Lubicon rights to their lands, and that intensive oil and gas development had devastated the Lubicon economy and way of life. That's 20 years ago. Today, the land dispute remains unresolved, while the harm experienced by the Lubicon people has only increased. After the soundtrack to the video, we're also going to present essays written by three young women of the Lubicon Nation that were personally presented to the United Nations last month.
I know my children and my grandchildren deserve what's rightfully theirs, and that's this land.
There was everything in here. You name it. Squirrel, moose, deer, coyote, bear, wolf. It was all here.
You know, a lot of the older people who have taken this fight to protect our land and save our land have left us, so that puts us in a situation with a bigger burden to continue that fight. And they've always stated that we've got to keep our land alive. For us, it's not a question of asking for land. We know it's our land. The problem is the province figures it's theirs, and they keep issuing licenses, permits to the oil and gas industry and also to the logging industry.
There are traditional territories like this. It starts up north and goes south to Township 81, because that's where we had sat down with our elders and where they had hunted and trapped for years.
There's three areas that they always wanted us to keep and protect for as long as we could. This one here at around Lubicon, the other one at Hague Lake, the other one at Bison Lake. There's three key areas. They're kind of the heart of our traditional area. And they all each had, roles to play. It had to do with, say, the animals and the soils that surround it for gardens and everything else. Like Hague Lake is good for fishing. It was kind of our stopover before we broke up into all the different groups throughout the year. And then back in the spring we'd do that and end up here.
Well, before, when we used to trap, that's back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, we used to trap link, fishers, rats, beavers, squirrels, whatever animal you can get, foxes and coyotes, wolves, and we had no roads at that time, no, nothing was snowplowed. We had to use dog teams and skinos. It was no fun, but that was life, eh? So, and the hunting is much poorer now than it was before, and the moose were healthier than years ago before the oil company showed up.
Along this lake here, they used to make hay here for their horses. Even that doesn't happen anymore. In 1978 and 79, when they pushed in an all-weather road in here, that's when the damage started here in our lands. It's big damage, huge, what it's done to my people up here. Heart of Lupicon land here, and they built this sour gas plant here. Then them trucks that you've seen coming in here, they go 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and all of the oil they're hauling into here is Lupicon oil. We never gave it up to nobody. Them are our resources. There's billions and billions of it, of the resources that come from Lupicon land. And my people are living in poverty up here. It happened soon after they come here, when there was 400 pumjacks that surrounded my people. Then they start having, our women start having problems with carrying babies. Like out of 21 pregnancies, there was 19 stillbirths. This is what's doing it.
It's been a long, hard struggle, and they're finding more and more oil and gas, and now we're talking tar sands. The logging companies want to come in and clear cut log, and all these things have had tremendous impact on in our ways, and that's where the scary part is. Very scary.
They don't really care what they damage. That's my main point. If this way, if we're aware that they're within our jurisdiction, who have control of that, making sure that they don't leave any spills or do unnecessary cutting, just unnecessary damage to the environment.
And we're trying to deal with people, you know, trying to meet with them to try and understand where we're coming from. Like, we have had many a discussion with these many different oil companies to try and get them to understand and try and look at the environment and the areas that they're proposing to do projects, so at least we have some contact with them, which is far, I think, more important, that they have a good understanding and trying to prevent any more damage than what's already there. But it's a continuing thing. It's an everyday kind of situation where you have to redo all this stuff. And the government stay. What can I say?
Yeah, what we have here is a pipeline that broke last year, and the company notified the band, and we came in with a few pieces of equipment and cleaned up what we could. But, pipeline breaks such as this, or where the contaminants are exposed to the ground, what happens is if there's any salt content, that you'll get the animals such as white-tailed deer coming in. The people here, the crew, dug, you know, as far as they could and took all the contaminants to the place here between here and Peace River, and had trucks that were lined with their boxes and hauled the dirt to a contaminated site. They got what they could, but as to getting it all, I don't think that happens. Like, the oil company is interested in making money, not spending it on where they have these pipeline breaks.
Winter it was logged, it looked like a war zone was through here. You're a young person. You'll never see it. Mature trees where they'll be harvested again. Takes that long. Our grandchildren won't see it.
And we're fighting like hell to prevent that from happening. But as they reduce us, to reduce our land, they get the upper hand. The more they destroy our land, the weaker they get us. Now, for example, even hunting moose and the wildlife that our people are dependent on, well, the more toxic they get, then, you know, it's a chain reaction. What happens to the moose comes back to our people.
The majority of our people can't afford good quality drinking water, which we have to get in Peace River, which is approximately 100 kilometers.
There's a water tank, a holding tank here for the school. We use that for washing dishes and bathing the kids and whatnot. But everything that we use for drinking is bottled water.
I have two daughters. I have one will be 12 in August, and the other one will be 14 on July 27th. And the only place that I can that they wash up is just it's like a horse trough. They bail in the water there. That's how they stay clean. Kids are forced into a situation where they have to drink the water that's not really drinkable, but that's what they have to get by.
The very least that they could do is put some kind of water and sewer system for our elders. But they've got a million reasons why they can't. And they want us to give up our Aboriginal right just for things like that. And it don't make any sense, because everybody else enjoys or figure those are just everyday luxuries that they may have. But in this case, no. When you look at these situations, it always boils back to jurisdiction, provincial jurisdiction. And for example, they this spring, the MD, Municipal District of Peace River, came out and said, we want to, you know, you poor Indians need water. And we're going to string a water line from the Peace River down below the DMI plant, and they want to string it out here. And then they want to have a little pump house in the community where we can haul it from instead of going to Peace River. But that water, under any circumstance, you know, however you treat it, is there's all kinds of stuff in the water, and it's below this pulp mill where the pulp mill dumps its garbage into, and it's below that, and it's not very far, maybe here to the truck. And supposedly they've got a system now that can, you know, clean the water, and that would be potable water for us. But the problem with that is what they're doing is trying to put infrastructure again into our area where they can open the area to outside settlers. No, it's got nothing to do with us. It's the same thing when they first brought in power and it went by us into a major oil field. So these are all tricks that they've seen and watched throughout these years. I mean, the list goes on as to what happens out here, especially where it's hidden. That's why it's critical for us that people on the outside at least know what's going on. They can't just walk in. And today is Canada Day. I remember a few years ago when they were threatening to come and bulldoze our homes on Canada Day.
They don't exist, and the proof is in our graveyards. We've lost our children and our grandchildren, our brothers and our sisters. There used to be just a few graves, like from 1978 and prior, but when they opened the road, it's their progress. And the graveyards are full now.
There's more sickness, there's more disease in them than you can think of, which we never had before.
There's more than, probably over more than half of the population is on welfare. There's a lot of drinking, alcohol, drugs, prescription abuse, they called, all that stuff.
We're having suicides now. Because there is no future that the young people see, and they basically give up.
Life is so precious that it far outweighs any economic situation. And in that regard, we are always taught that we got to try and help one another. If somebody is hungry, you feed them. Or if somebody can't do something for themselves and you're able and to do that for them, then that's what you go and do. So it's been a struggle having been put in a situation where you're kind of welfare dependent to retain that, because that social fabric of any society doesn't have to be native. You do that to a white community, you would see the vast changes with that society in a very short term.
Say a single mother with two kids. All she gets is 345, and that's supposed to last her all month. Like, how is she supposed to support her kids and get whatever she needs? I don't think a lot of the young girls know what to do if they were to be asked to fix something, even the fur, or not sure a lot of people know how to do the dry meat or even fix a moose or anything like that. Because they just hardly ever see it. Well, and me, I lost a little boy 14 months ago, and it really seemed to open my eyes. Like, I really realized, like, how precious these kids are. Mind you, I never allowed alcohol or drugs or anything in my house. Like, I tried to raise my kids the way I thought was right. And I still ended up losing my little one.
You know, if you look in a dictionary of what's happening when they mention cultural genocide, and you look what's happening to our people, to a small group like us, and the consequences and all the things that surround us, the word defines what's transpiring here.
Stayed together, and we laugh and we all cry together, because we've taken direction from the elders that are gone now, that to never to give up what's rightfully ours, and they were speaking of the land.
We do a bit of work for oil companies to keep our young people employed so our kids could have something. Especially at Christmas time.
That's where we got a real fine balance there, where we're trying to do some work and at the same time not get involved where we see they're destroying the land. It's really, really tricky. But having said that, what we try to do is, like, for example, when they knock trees down to build an oil lease, or if they knock trees down to build a road or a power line or whatever, pipeline, we take them trees, we get them, we bring them back to the yard. Then we either give them to a sawmill, they come and get them, and then they give us lump exchange. And we bring that to the community for the community to use.
I'm just trying to make something new in the community, I guess. A different house, a new house, I guess that's all I could say. Something, try it different. Maybe other people will be interested in houses like this. See how much it costs to build one. Once we start, then it'll be easier and as we go, I guess.
Every summer we do what we call a summer work program, where we take the kids who have been in school, take them for 2 weeks, and they go to work, 9 to 5. We try to teach them good work ethic, hard work, and where it's going to take you. And because they're in school, that's the incentive to stay in school, so you can, you know, go to work in the summer, which has helped a lot of kids stay in school because that's what they wanted. And the jobs they would do, like, aren't really big, but they just, like, cleaning up the community, cleaning up the graveyards, cleaning up, like, the elders' yards and stuff, like, just little things, but it would give them pride.
We've always had horses. We grew up around horses. We hunted and done things. And there's where we can't do too much of that now because of the development that surrounds us. So we got to keep our horses penned up, which is not good on one hand because they like their freedom just as much as we like our freedom. The young people, they get a, you know, they ride and they get into these gymkhana and things. So they recognize there's some responsibilities that go along with this stuff. The decrease in wildlife, for example, moose, where we're dependent on that meat for everyday use. We figured, well, we'll try buffalo. You know, there's a few of the younger people that say, hey, those are our pets, we can't eat them. But I mean, in the long run, we're hoping that we can, you know, establish that. And it's part of trying to rebuild our community. I don't think, you know, money is a solution. I think we've got enough young people who can, you know, stand up and be counted on for them to be able to pick up the pieces and build something for the future.
We live on unceded territory, and the province doesn't really have the authority to permit anyone just to come in and take our natural resources.
We're the ones that are being greedy. That's the way they see us. And that's the way the government's portrayed this, you know, with this media that they put out constantly year after year after year. And what all we're asking for is to be a viable community.
I think they think we're lazy and greedy when they don't even know the real story. Like, they don't know what's behind everything. Here they're getting rich off our land, and we're not even getting anything. Like, we're still in the same spot we were how many years ago. And it just makes me angry. And a lot of times they see an Indian drinking right away. He's a lazy, no good bum, and they don't even know what kind of life he had or why he's in that situation he's in.
They know very well that giving out these licenses, that they're asserting jurisdiction when they know bloody well that they don't.
Like, the term blackmail really does it just defines everything. It's because we don't just, okay, we won't back down. Because we won't back down, there's certain things that are taken from us. The services that we need are taken from us. The housing, the money we need for housing is taken from us. And it's just like a trade-off. And it's really sad, because then, like, we're being punished because we stand up for what we believe in.
We're not going to get on our hands and knees to these guys and say, please give us something. We're beyond those times.
The Libukan people have fought for so long, and we will keep fighting until we get something that's just and fair. Like, we're not going to give up, and as long as there's Libukan people left, we will continue fighting.
They may talk about law, then they should look at the law and how the rest of Canada has been dealt with and how the people have been dealt with. And even then, to this day, we got friends all throughout Canada, for example, First Nation people, Aboriginal people, who are all in little boxes, just like our horses there. And I don't think that's fair by any means, but that's the kind of treaty they sign, which the governments don't respect. So those are all part and parcel of what we look at in order to try and achieve a settlement that's going to allow our people to build a future on, our young people to build something on. And anything short of that, then this fight is going to continue.
And we're back, and I just wanted to mention, there's, for those of you, one of the many facts here, there's over 2,000 existing oil and gas wells on Libukan Cree land, and the Alberta government approves about 100 new wells yearly. It just goes on and on. And Mona, we have a special guest who has appeared.
We do. We have a special guest. Oh, I'll move the mic over. It's a little far away. Our special guest is Garson Hunter, Professor Garson Hunter from the University of Regina. We're going to talk to Garson a little later, but you could say hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Garson's been involved in the case of the Libukan Cree for many, many, many years, almost since the inception of the issue as it was raised with the Canadian government from the band itself. So we're going to get his perspective on the history of it. But before we do that, what I would like to do is maybe give you a little history myself. And then after that, I want to talk about what the young ladies from the Libukan Nation have written when they presented some information from their perspective in the form of essays to the United Nations a month ago. This issue goes back to about 1984, when the Libukan Band had filed a formal complaint charging that Canada was violating the Libukan people's right to self-determination, and that the band had exhausted all domestic remedies in trying to stop the practice of cultural, if not physical, genocide. Chief Omniak stated the Libukan people have survived off the land all these years, but since the oil companies have come in, they've destroyed the whole environment, therefore destroying our way of life, which is hunting and trapping. 7 months before the 1988 Olympics in Calgary, the United Nations Human Rights Committee in Geneva announced that it would hear the Libukan case. And this was the result of that was the formal complaint that had been filed in 1984, and they heard this case. Now, what I'd like to move on to from here is Amnesty International's involvement has been around for quite a while. And Craig Benjamin, who was Amnesty International's campaigner for the human rights of Indigenous peoples, stated that for two decades, international human rights bodies, so it's not just Amnesty International, but other bodies, have condemned Canada for the failure to recognize and uphold the rights of the Libukan Cree. Now, to mark this anniversary of March 26, 1990, when the United Nations Human Rights Committee ruled that Canada had violated the human rights of the Libukan Cree, we're going to listen to the stories of three Libukan students who wrote powerfully poignant essays to give us a glimpse of what it's been like for young people to grow up in the midst of these violations. Letitia Gladue, Daphne Omniak, and Dawn Sisiquin traveled to the UN in New York as part of a delegation sponsored by Amnesty International, the Canadian Friends Service Committee, that's the Quakers, Kairos, and the Alberta Federation of Labor and the Agriculture Union, or PSAC. Amnesty International would also like to thank the three judges at the United Nations who reviewed the essays, Ojibwe author and playwright Drew Hayden Taylor, Kenneth Deere, a Mohawk journalist and a member of the board of the UN Voluntary Fund for Indigenous Populations, and Sarah Pocklington, a Cree Métis educator and a member of the award-winning musical group Asani. These are quotes from some of the judges. All three demonstrated an understanding of human rights as applied to their particular situation in Little Buffalo. You can feel the emotion in their writing and the anger at the system that has denied them their rights. It's sad to see such anger in teenagers, but fabulous that they are expressing it in this manner. These three are far better writers than I was at that age. I'm a little envious. That was a statement by Drew Hayden Taylor. Now I will read excerpts from the three winning essays. The first one is titled Living in the Third World. Nobody Should Be Living Like This, by Dawn Sisiquin, age 17. This is our land, not the government's. They come in here and take our resources, which include oil and gas, which gets them an abundance of money. We, as owners of this land, only get information of the violation and either receive very little out of it or nothing at all. How would you, the people of the government, like it if other governments went onto your land and took away what you valued most, without your permission and denying your rights to the land? My grandmother and mother have a trap line of their own on which they go hunting and snaring, but it is rare that they will bring any rabbits, moose, deer, prairie chickens, or even black bears back home. With all these roads, semis, loud machinery, and cutting down of the forests, wildlife has been scared. This has affected our way of life, the Aboriginal peoples of Lubicon Lake Nation. Simply because our tradition is to hunt and bring home moose meat, chicken and rabbit for the family to feast on, and to make moose and squirrel hide to sell and get money in exchange. But by not having the right to change this intrusion, it is rare that this will happen, and our tradition will eventually fade away. We, Lubicon Lake Nation members, have the right to control our land, live our way of life without it being destroyed in any way, develop our community, use our territories without any exploitation from the government, and live healthy lives. My family, myself, as well as the other families in the community deserve better. Especially the elders. This is their home and has been for decades. This is their settlement, Little Buffalo. They have been fighting and continue to fight for the benefit and healthier lifestyle for the families and upcoming generations. A distant elder family member who died by the disease called tuberculosis in 2003 was due to the government exploiting our land and also causing other respiratory problems, such as asthma, to the people of Little Buffalo. Now, this is something I do not want other family members to go through, suffering and having their lives shortened, causing grief and mourning to the community. The government should really think of the health problems and damages they are creating for the people of Lubicon Lake Nation. This exploitation has really affected my life because this is just inhumane and unnecessary living conditions, such as no indoor facilities, unhealthy lifestyles, families depending on welfare, traveling 1 to 2 hour distances just to hunt and trap, and most importantly, not being able to develop our own community. I'm appalled by this violation because I believe that every individual should have their rights fully respected and honored. And that was the essay written by Dawn Sisiquin, age 17. I will now read the essay written by Daphne Omniak, age 16. It is titled, What Does Human Rights Mean to You? If you were asked, what are human rights? You would get all kinds of answers. Human rights are the rights to which everyone is entitled, no matter who they are or where they come from, but simply because they are alive. What I will be talking about is why we should have the rights to running water and health aids in my hometown known as Little Buffalo. I will also be talking about how us people cope with these issues. The school, health center, band office, and very few houses are the only places that actually do have the running water supply. And those places still have a limited supply, which has to be trucked into the community. Like the school, for example, is based on if there is enough supply, and if there isn't school, it's usually shut down for the following day. This issue is pretty big, but it's not unbearable. The people have been trying to fix the problem for a while now, but the goal of it has not yet been achieved. This issue of no running water can be hard to deal with, but no doubt, I just hope that the people will keep fighting for their rights. Eventually, this problem of no running water will be solved. The people, no matter who it is, they just need to stay confident and stand out if they believe that running water and health aid is what we need. People who are fighting are what will make them recognized not only in this situation. People like this are who should and hopefully will be recognized. Even if it means doing things alone, you can definitely still be recognized. So here I am trying to recognize my hometown, though I'm not a very recognized person throughout my hometown. Being confident and not so shy is something I'm working on. I'm standing up for what I believe in. This is the place that I come from. And that was written by Daphne Omniak, age 16. And the last essay I will read is written by Letitia Gladue. She's a 15-year-old young lady from the Lubicon Cree. It is titled, My People, My Community, and Me. How our human rights are repeatedly being violated and ignored. Human rights mean different things to different people. But the question here is, what does human rights mean to me? And how does this affect me, my family, and also my community? I have to consider how my rights and my people's rights have been violated over hundreds of years. As a 15-year-old teenager taking grade 10 in a little reserve called Little Buffalo, I see our rights constantly violated. Little Buffalo has no recreation, nor any indoor plumbing, no gas station or grocery store, not even a health facility. The people of Lubicon have to travel about an hour and a half just to get to the nearest hospital and grocery stores. This is what really grinds my gears and disappoints me. Why can't my people and I just have a nice, clean, healthy, little happy community? At the end of the day, we, the Lubicon people, and myself, are affected because here in our community, we don't have indoor plumbing, and the water we use, we haul it by trucks from a central water plant to our homes. We don't have grocery stores. We don't have a recreation center. We don't have a health facility, not to mention 90% of the people here are forced to get income through welfare because there are no jobs here. Even families here don't have enough room for their children because the houses are so small. This affects me and my community by not having the right to be safe and the right to have and live a healthy life. So here, some kids run to drugs and alcohol, for they feel that there is nothing here for them. Even my friends say this repeatedly, that why can't our community have something here for us to be interested in, to keep us out of trouble, not to mention the health? Here we don't have paved roads, for we have dirt roads. And in the summer, we get this type of mixed oil that just reeks, but is used to keep the dirt down. But yet, it still causes respiratory problems for our elders and kids and other people, period. This is our land. We the people have more than rights to make a difference, and we will. We don't have much, but we will fight for what we want and need for our little community. So I hope that by writing this essay, our human rights will be respected so we can finally have the life we want and deserve. And that last essay was written by Letitia Gladue. She's 15 years old, from Little Buffalo in Lubicon Cree Nation. when I read these essays, I took an opportunity to connect with the woman who was responsible for taking them to the UN, and her name is Dietland. What's her last name, Jim? I can't remember. Sorry about that, Dietland. But her name is Dietland, and I responded to Dietland through Facebook, asking if I could ask a couple of questions from the young ladies who don't have internet. But fortunately, they have cell phones, and the text message back their responses to my questions. And the two questions I asked the young ladies was, what was the response from the UN committee to your presentations? And would you like to express your feelings about the whole experience for the people who are listening to Human Rights Radio? The two responses we received back through text message was one from Letitia, who replied, hey, okay, well, the response from the UN people was they were shocked and really interested in what was going on in our community. And also, I'd like to express my feelings by telling everyone out there listening, just support us three, because we're getting somewhere. Enough is enough, and I will not tolerate this no longer. Go Lubicon. It was a pleasure doing this interview. And the second response I received was from Daphne Dawn Omniak, and she responded through text message. Well, from the Human Rights Committee, I gotta agree with Tish. They were all shocked and seemed pretty interested. That's pretty much what everybody said, and that they would try doing whatever they could to help. For the second question, well, first, thanks to whoever is listening. The more people they have to hear and pay attention to what we say just encourages me that much more. Honestly, I never thought that just from writing the essays we would get noticed this much. Still shocked, but it's just the beginning, and we are already making a difference. Just hope that by keeping this up, something is going to be fixed in our community. And now I'd like to turn over the rest of the show to Garson Hunter.
That's Dietland Lauren, by the way.
Dietland Lauren?
Yes.
Okay, there we go. Dietland Lauren was the woman who accompanied the three young women to the United Nations last month. So, Garson, the reason you're on the show is because you have been involved with this issue since the early 1980s with the Lubicon Cree. Could you tell us a little bit about how that started and what you'd like to talk about?
Yeah. First, it's so wonderful to hear the voices of Lubicon Cree Nation, both through their video and also through the voices of these young women, rather than people like myself. It's good to hear that they're speaking and their voice and how powerful those voices really are. And to hear these young women, I had no awareness of that when I was their age. So what a compliment to them and to themselves. And it just underlines the reason why we need to hear the First Nations voices on this issue. And more they're doing. They're being allowed to do that. So that's just great. My involvement came with the call by Chief Omniak to boycott the 88 Winter Olympic Games in Calgary. People might say, well, how or why? Well, the main sponsors of that Olympic Games, the cultural aspect, were Petro-Canada and Shell, who were the oil gas companies that were on their territory extracting the oil and gas wealth from them. So that's where my involvement came into it, was with the 88 Olympics and the call for the boycott, which was well received by the cultural community, meaning the museums in Europe who held First Nations artifacts in their collections. They did, in fact, honor the call for the boycott and refused to share their museum collection with the collection in Calgary, Alberta, at the Glenbow Museum. So that really goes back to my involvement. My involvement was working with Chief Omniak, working with our alongside of the Lubicon Lake Nation on their cause to be heard. At that time, as you had mentioned, this was when the United Nations were beginning to hear their complaints, 1987, which you mentioned, which finally resulted in their ruling in 1990 that their rights are being violated. It had such an impact on me. Omniak had such an impact on me that I continue to use their material when I teach my courses on social change at university. I use a large section from the book Last Stand of the Lubicon Nation by Goddard, and we go through it. How did the How did the Lubicon Lake Nation attempt to have their voices heard? How were they received in Calgary? And I've noticed such a change even there, because I was also part of the protest with the First Nations in Vancouver for this Olympics. Back then, there was maybe 300 people. We were vilified when the torch came to Calgary. We were abused by the crowd that was present, and the police refused to protect the Lubicon people who were standing up for their cause at the Calgary Olympics. And in fact, in my naive white way, I walked up to the undercover police who were among us and said, why aren't you stopping this? Why aren't you doing something to protect these people, especially the children who were getting cut with ice that was being thrown at us? And the police did turn to the Calgary Herald reporter and said, be sure to tell your, write it to your readers what the public thinks of these effing Indians. This is exactly what he said. He actually used the F word. And the Calgary Herald did report it. There were calls for investigation of racism among the Calgary police, but it went nowhere. Well, you wouldn't get away with that today. Being with the Olympic Resistance Network in Vancouver, their theme was no Olympics on stolen native land. And there were thousands of people out, and thousands of people were chanting that slogan. So there is a change in Canadian public's attitudes when they become aware of what these people are facing and what they deal with. When we hear of no water and the high rates of tuberculosis, which are highest anywhere in the world, it's because they don't have water. We have the ongoing tar sands, which is just exasperating their condition there. We continue to have oil and gas extraction from their territory. No wonder the government won't settle this claim with honor. They'll settle it when there's nothing left for these people. And I just want to honor Bernard Omniak's statement back in the early 80s when he refused to allow the government to do this to them. He said, I will not negotiate away my people. The government has always tried to undercount the number of people they consider actual Lubicon Cree.
Okay. Thank you very much for that history, Garson. There's one thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the connection between the Olympics and the First Nation people. And I've heard repeatedly, particularly since our 2010 Olympics, and the mass media airing of the, I'm not just talking about television and radio, but obviously about internet as well. YouTube has a lot of videos about the protests against using native land.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've gone out in public and I've heard people say, it doesn't make sense to me because there were First Nation people who were at the Olympics, at the opening ceremonies, at the closing ceremonies, and they were dancing and they were looking like they were having a good time. There were documentaries created from some First Nations that were stating that they were happy to have the Olympics in Vancouver because it gave them the opportunity to show off their culture to the world. And it seems to be such a dichotomous event here where we've got on one side thousands of people protesting the use of Aboriginal land, and on the other side you're seeing Aboriginal people who are saying, well, we're happy having the Olympics here. So how do we resolve this?
Yeah.
What's it about?
One of the things we need to look at is the way the Indian Act was set up. We must remember that First Nations were not organized along the lines of what we see today in the Indian Act. Again, it stands to the strength of the Lubicon people and Bernard Omniak that all these years they've refused and resisted this co-option of their cause within Canada, trying to use it as a charming artifact of these people's history for publicity reasons. I'll just quickly talk about don't the 2010 Olympics have the support of natives through the Four Horse Nations. The Vancouver Olympics, we need to remember, is on unceded coast Salish territory, meaning there are no treaties with these groups in Vancouver or British Columbia. British Columbia, by the time the negotiators reached the territory of British Columbia, they stopped doing treaties. So they don't have treaties like we have out here in Ontario or on the prairies back east. So there are no treaties. I'll just quickly read from the Olympic Resistance Network, which I was part of this past Olympics. It was kind of funny, actually. I got to say to a lot of people, how many people here have been for part of both Native resistance to Canadian Winter Games? Of course, there are so many great young people involved. I was the only one. The Four Host Nations is a corporate body made up primarily of government-funded Inuit Band Council chiefs, not hereditary chieftainships, said Selisham, a Litwat elder. An overwhelming number of Indigenous people in these territories and in the interior are opposed to the Olympics because of the long-term impact, including destruction of land, commodification of Native art and culture, and the creation of long-term poverty, where only a few token jobs are gone. In the reality, a strong opposition to the Olympic Games by Native peoples has forced the Vancouver Organizing Committee to desperately try and create the perception of Native support by throwing a lot of money to a few select people.
Thank you. We appreciate that. There's your connection, and that's what's happening. And Jim, if people would like to see this video online, where can they go to see the video that we showed at the top of the show about the Lubicon Cree?
They just have to go to amnesty.ca/Lubicon, and they'll find it there.
Right. And yep. There's also a website for Friends of the Lubicon they can go
yes.
to.
Yep, exactly. And along with thousands of Canadians, members of Parliament have been signing the National Lubicon Petition calling on the government to resume negotiations with the Lubicon Nation. We are aiming for a majority of Parliament to support the Lubicon people in their struggle for justice, and with your help, we think we can do it. You can personally speak out and sign petitions or write letters to the Canadian government by going to Friends of the Lubicon and Amnesty International Lubicon on your web browser. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, you can go to cjtr.ca and look at our blog. Peter Bedinson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."